4. By the time he passed the Troy General Store, his euphoria had dissipated, and his former low nervousness had returned. The sky overhead was a clear blue in which a few wispy white clouds floated, but his nerves felt as if there were a thunderstorm on the way. He glanced at the flat pack on the seat beside him, the gold cup covered with a round of cellophane which read, "Sani sealed for your protection."
In other words,
Leandro thought,
microbes keep out.
No cars on the road. No tractors in the fields. No boys walking barefoot along the side of the road with fishing rods. Troy dreamed silent, and Leandro guessed, toothless, under the August sun. He kept the radio turned to WZON, and as he passed the Baptist church, he began to lose the signal in a rising mutter of other voices. Not long after that, his cheeseburgers began to first walk around uneasily in his stomach, and then to jump up and down. He could imagine them squirting grease as they did so. He was very close to the place where he had pulled over on his first effort to get into Haven. He pulled over now without delay. He didn't want the symptoms to get any worse. Those cheeseburgers had been too damned good to lose. 5. With the oxygen mask in place, the queasiness went away at once. That sense of low, gnawing nervousness did not. He caught a glimpse of himself, gold cup bobbing on his mouth and nose, in the rearview mirror, and felt a moment of fright. Was that him? That man's eyes looked too serious, too intent. They looked like the eyes of a jet fighter pilot. Leandro didn't want people like David Bright to think he was a twerp, but he wasn't sure he wanted to look that serious.
Too late now. You're in it.
The radio babbled in 100 voices, maybe 1,000. Leandro turned it off, and there, up ahead, was the Haven Town line. Leandro, who knew nothing at all about invisible nylon stockings, drove up to the town line marker, and then passed it into Haven, with no trouble at all. Although the battery situation in Haven was approaching the critical point again, force fields could have been set up along most of the roads leading into town. But in the frightened confusion over the developing events of the morning, Dick Allison and Newt had made one decision that came to directly affect John Leandro. They wanted Haven closed, but they didn't want anyone to strike an inexplicable barrier in the middle of what appeared to be thin air, turn around and carry the tale back to the wrong people, which was everyone else on Earth just now.
"I don't believe anyone could get that close,"
Newt said. He and Dick were in Dick's pickup truck, part of a procession of cars and trucks racing out to Bobby Anderson's place.
"I used to think so, too,"
Dick replied.
"But that was before Hillman and Bobby's sister. No, someone could get in, but if they do, they'll never get out again." "All right, fine, you're queen for a day. Now can't you drive this fucker any faster?"
The texture of both men's thoughts, of the thoughts all around them, was dismayed and furious. At that moment, the possible incursion of outsiders into Haven seemed the least of their worries.
"I knew we should have gotten rid of that goddamn drunk!"
Dick cried out loud and slammed his fist down on the dashboard. He was wearing no makeup today. His skin, as well as becoming increasingly transparent, had begun to roughen. The center of his face, and Newt's face, and the faces of all those who had spent time in Bobby's shed, had begun to swell, to grow decidedly snout-like. 6. John Leandro, of course, knew nothing of this. He knew only that the air around him was poisonous, more poisonous than even he would have believed. He had slipped the gold cup down long enough to take a single shallow breath, and the world had immediately begun to fade into dimness. He put the cup back quickly, heart racing, hands cold. Some 200 yards past the town line marker, his Dodge simply died. Most Haven cars and trucks had been customized in such a way as to make them immune to the steadily increasing electromagnetic field thrown off by the ship in the Earth over the last 2 months or so. Much of this work was done at Elt Barker's shell. But Leandro's car had undergone no such treatment. He sat behind the wheel a moment, staring stupidly down at the red idiot lights. He threw the transmission into park and turned the key. The motor didn't crank. Hell, the solenoid didn't even click.
Battery cable came off, maybe. It wasn't a battery cable. If it had been, the oil and amp lights wouldn't be glowing. But that was minor. Mostly, he knew it wasn't his battery cable just because he knew it. There were trees along both sides of the road here. The sun, through their moving leaves, made dappled patterns on the asphalt and white dirt of the soft shoulders. Leandro suddenly felt that eyes were looking out at him from behind trees. This was silly, of course, but the idea was nonetheless very powerful.
Okay, now you have to get out and see if you can walk out of the poison belt before your air runs out. The odds get longer every second you sit here giving yourself the creeps.
He tried the ignition key once more. Still nothing. He got his camera, hooked the strap over his shoulder, and got out. He stood looking uneasily at the woods on the right side of the road. He thought he heard something behind him, a shuffling sound, and whirled quickly, lips pulled up in a dry grin of fear. Nothing. Nothing he could see.
The woods are lovely, dark and deep. Get moving. You're just standing here using up your air.
He opened the door again, leaned in, and got the gun out of the glove compartment. He loaded it, then tried to put it in his right front pocket. It was too big. He was afraid it would fall out and go off if he left it there. He pulled up his new T-shirt, stuck it in his belt, then pulled the shirt down over it. He looked at the woods again, then bitterly at the car. He could take pictures, he supposed, but what would they show? Nothing but a deserted country road. You could see those all over the state, even at the height of the summer tourist season. The pictures wouldn't convey the lack of woods sounds. The pictures would not show that the air had been poisoned.
There goes your scoop, Johnny. Oh, you'll write plenty of stories about it, and I've got a feeling you'll be telling a lot of network news filming crews, which is your good side. But your picture on the cover of Newsweek? The Pulitzer Prize? Forget it.
Part of him, a more adult part, insisted that was dumb, that half a loaf was better than none, that most of the reporters in the world would kill to get just a slice from this loaf, whatever it turned out to be. But John Leandro was a man younger than his 24 years. When David Bright believed he had seen a generous helping of twerp in Leandro, he hadn't been wrong. There were reasons, of course, but the reasons didn't change the fact. He felt like a rookie who gets a fat pitch during his first at-bat in the majors and hits an opposite-field triple. Not bad. But in his heart, a voice cries out, "Hey, God, if you was gonna give me a fat one, why didn't you let me get it all?" Haven Village was less than a mile away. He could walk it in 15 minutes, but then he would never get out of the poison belt before the air in the flat pack ran out, and he knew it.
If only I'd rented two of these goddamn things. Even if you'd thought of it, you didn't have cash enough to pay the frigging security deposit on two. The question is, Johnny, do you want to die for your scoop or not?
He didn't. If his picture was going to be on the cover of Newsweek, he didn't want there to be a black border around it. He began to trudge back toward the Troy town line. He got 5 dozen steps before realizing he could hear engines. A lot of them, very faint.
Something going on over on the other side of town. Might as well be something happening on the dark side of the moon. Forget it.
With another uneasy glance at the woods, he started walking again. Got another dozen steps and realized he could hear another sound, a low approaching hum from behind him. He turned. His jaw dropped. In Haven, most of July had been Municipal Gadget Month. As the becoming progressed, most Havenites had lost interest in such things, but the gadgets were still there. Strange white elephants, such as the ones Gardner had seen in Bobby's shed. Many had been pressed into service as border guards. Hazel McCready sat in her town hall office before a bank of earphones, monitoring each briefly in turn. She was furious at being left behind to do this duty while the future of everything hung in the balance out at Bobby's farm. But now, someone had entered town after all. Glad of the diversion, Hazel moved to take care of the intruder. 7. It was the Coke machine, which had been in front of Cooter's Market. Leandro stood frozen with amazement, watching it approach. A jolly red-and-white rectangle, 6.5 feet high and 4 wide. It was slicing rapidly through the air toward him, its bottom about 18 inches over the road.
I've fallen into an ad,
Leandro thought.
Some kind of weird ad. In a second or two, the door of that thing will open and O.J. Simpson is going to come flying out.
It was a funny idea.
Leandro started to laugh. Even as he was laughing, it occurred to him that here was the picture. Oh, God, here was the picture. Here was a Coca-Cola vending machine floating up a rural stretch of two-lane blacktop. He grabbed for the Nikon. The Coke machine, humming to itself, banked around Leandro's stalled car and came on. It looked like a madman's hallucination, but the front of the machine proclaimed that however much one might want to believe the contrary, this was the real thing. Still giggling, Leandro realized it wasn't stopping. It was, in fact, speeding up. And what was a soda machine, really? A refrigerator with ads on it, and refrigerators were heavy. The Coke machine, a red-and-white guided missile, slid through the air at Leandro. The wind made a tiny, hollow, hooting noise in the coin return. Leandro forgot the picture. He leapt to the left. The Coke machine struck his right shin and broke it. For a moment, his leg was nothing but a bolt of pure white pain. He screamed into the gold cup as he landed on his stomach at the side of the road, tearing his shirt open. The Nikon flew to the end of its strap and hit the gravelly, soft shoulder with a crunch.
Oh, you son of a bitch, that camera cost $400.
He got to his knees and turned around, shirt torn open, chest bleeding, legs screaming. The Coke machine banked back. It hung in the air for a moment, its front turning back and forth in small arcs that reminded Leandro of the sweeps of a radar dish. The sun flashed off its glass door. Leandro could see bottles of Coke and Fanta inside. Suddenly, it pointed at him and accelerated toward him.
Found me. Christ!
He got up and tried to hop toward his car on his left foot. The soda machine bore down on him, coin return hooting dismally. Shrieking, Leandro threw himself forward and rolled. The Coke machine missed him by perhaps 4 inches. He landed in the road. Pain bellowed up his broken leg. Leandro screamed. The machine turned, paused, found him, and started back again. Leandro groped for the pistol in his belt and brought it out. He fired 4 times, balanced on his knees. Each bullet went home. The third shattered the machine's glass door. The last thing Leandro saw before the machine, which weighed just a bit over 600 pounds, hit him, was various soft drinks foaming and dripping from the broken necks of the bottles his bullets had shattered. Broken bottlenecks coming at him at 40 miles an hour.
Mama!
Leandro's mind shrieked, and he threw his arms up in front of his face in a crisscross. He didn't have to worry about jagged bottlenecks, after all, or the microbes which might have been in the cheeseburgers from the Burger Ranch, for that matter. One of life's great truths is this. When one is about to be struck by a speeding 600-pound Coke machine, one need worry about nothing else. There was a thudding, crunching sound. The front of Leandro's skull shattered like a Ming vase hurled onto the floor. A split second later, his spine snapped. For a moment, the machine carried him along, plastered to it like a very large bug plastered to the windshield of a fast-moving car. His flayed legs dragged on the road, the white line unreeling between them. The heels of his loafers eroded to smoking rubber nodules. One fell off. Then he slid down the front of the vending machine and flopped onto the road. The Coke machine started back toward Haven Village. Its coin holder had been jarred when the machine hit Leandro, and as it moved rapidly through the air, humming, a steady stream of quarters, nickels, and dimes spewed out of the coin return and went rolling about on the road. Chapter 8. Guard and Bobby. 1. Gardner knew that Bobby would make her move soon. The old Bobby had fulfilled what the new and improved Bobby saw as its last obligation to good old Jim Gardner, who had come to save his friend and who had stayed on to whitewash one hell of a strange fence. He thought, in fact, that it would be the sling, that Bobby would want to go up first and, once up, would simply not send it back down. There he'd be, down by the hatch, and there he'd die, next to that strange symbol. Bobby wouldn't even have to deal with the messy reality of murder. There would be no need to think about good old Guard dying slowly and miserably of starvation, either. Good old Guard would die of multiple hemorrhages very quickly. But Bobby insisted that Guard go up first, and the sardonic cut of her eyes told Gardner that Bobby knew exactly what he had been thinking, and she hadn't had to read his mind to do it, either. The sling rose in the air, and Gardner clung tightly to the cable, fighting a need to vomit. That need, he thought, was quickly going to become impossible to deny. But Bobby had sent him a thought which came through loud and clear as soon as they wriggled out through the hatch again.
Don't take the mask off until you get topside.
Were Bobby's thoughts clearer, or was it his imagination? No, not imagination. They had both gotten another boost inside the ship.
His nose was still bleeding and his shirt was sopping with it. The air mask was filling up. It was by far the worst nosebleed he'd had since Bobby first brought him out here.
Why not?
He had sent back, trying to be very careful and send only that top thought, nothing below it.
Most of the machines we heard were air exchangers. Breathing what's in the trench now would do you in just as quick as breathing what was in the ship when we first opened it. The two won't equalize for the rest of the day. Maybe longer.
Not the sort of thinking one would usually suspect in a woman who wanted to kill you. But that look was still in Bobby's eyes, and the feel of it colored all of Bobby's thoughts. Hanging onto the cable for dear life, biting at the rubber pegs, Gardner fought to hold on to his stomach. The sling reached the top. He wandered away on legs that felt as if they were made of rubber bands and paper clips, barely seeing the Electrolux and the length of cable manipulating the buttons.
Count 10,
he thought.
Count 10. Get as far from the trench as you can, then take off the mask and take what comes. I think I'd rather die than feel like this anyway.
He got as far as 5 and could hold back no longer. Crazy images danced before his eyes, dumping the drink down Patricia McCardle's dress, seeing Bobby reeling off her porch to greet him when he finally arrived. The big man with a gold cup over his mouth and nose, turning to look at him from the passenger window of a 4-wheel drive as Gardner lay drunk on the porch.
If I'd dug in a few different places out of that gravel pit, why, I just might have found that one, too,
he thought. And that was when his stomach finally rebelled. He tore the mouthpiece off and threw up, groping for a pine tree at the edge of the clearing and clinging to it for support. He did it again, and realized he had never experienced this sort of vomiting in his entire life. He had read about it, however. He was ejecting stuff, most of it bloody, in wads that flew like bullets. And bullets were almost what they were. He was having a seizure of projectile vomiting. This was not considered a sign of good health in medical circles. Gray veil drifted over his sight. His knees buckled.
Oh, fuck, I'm dying,
he thought. But the idea seemed to have no emotional gradient. It was dreary news, no more, no less. He felt his hand slipping down the rough bark of the pine. He felt tarry sap. Faintly, he was aware that the air smelled foul and yellow and sulfuric. It was the way a paper mill smells after a week of still overcast weather. He didn't care. Whether there were Elysian fields or just a big black nothing, there would not be that stink. So maybe he would come out a winner anyway. Best to just let go. To just...
No. No, you will not just let go. You came back to save Bobby, and Bobby was maybe already beyond saving. But that kid's around, and he might not be. Please, guard. At least try.
Don't let it be for nothing,
he said in a cracked, wavering voice.
Jesus Christ, please don't let it be for nothing.
The wavering gray mists cleared a little. The vomiting subsided. He raised a hand to his face and flung away a sheet of blood with it. A hand touched the back of his neck as he did, and Gardner's flesh pebbled with goosebumps. A hand. Bobby's hand. But not a human hand. Not anymore.
Guard, are you all right?
All right,
he answered aloud and managed to get to his feet. The world wavered, then came back into focus. The first thing he saw in it was Bobby. The look on Bobby's face was one of cold, cheerless calculation. He saw no love there, not even a counterfeit of concern. Bobby had become beyond such things.
Let's go,
Gardner said hoarsely.
You drive. I'm feeling...
He stumbled and had to grab at Bobby's bunched, strained shoulder to keep from falling.
A little under the weather.
2. By the time they got back to the farm, Gardner was better. The bleeding from his nose had subsided to a trickle. He had swallowed a fair amount of blood while wearing the mouthpiece, and a lot of the blood he had seen in his vomit must have been that. He hoped. He had lost a total of 9 teeth.
I want to change my shirt,
he told Bobby. Bobby nodded without much interest. Come on out in the kitchen after you do, she said. We have to talk.
Yes,
I suppose we do. In the guest room, Gardner took off the T-shirt he had been wearing and put on a clean one. He let it hang down over his belt. He went to the foot of the bed, lifted the mattress, and got the .45. He tucked it into his pants. The T-shirt was too big. He had lost a lot of weight. The outline of the gun butt hardly showed at all if he sucked in his gut. He paused for a moment longer, wondering if he was ready for this. He supposed there was no way to tell such a thing in advance. A dull headache gnawed his temples, and the world seemed to move in and out of focus in slow, woozy cycles. His mouth hurt, and his nose felt stuffed with drying blood. This was it. As much a showdown as any Bobby had ever written in her westerns. High noon in central Maine. Make your play, pard. A ghost of a smile touched his lips. All of those two-for-a-penny sophomore philosophers said life was a strange proposition, but really this was outrageous. He went out to the kitchen. Bobby was sitting at the kitchen table, watching him. Strange, half-glimpsed green fluid circulated below the surface of her transparent face. Her eyes, larger, the pupils oddly misshapen, looked at Gardner somberly. On the table was a boombox radio. Dick Allison had brought it out to Bobby's 3 days ago at her request. It was the one Hank Buck had used to send Fitz Barfield to that great repel-depple in the sky. It had taken Bobby less than 20 minutes to connect its circuitry to the toy photon pistol she was pointing at Gardner. On the table were two beers and a bottle of pills. Gardner recognized the bottle. Bobby must have gone into the bathroom and gotten it while he was changing his shirt. It was his Valium. "Sit down, guard," Bobby said. 3. Gardner had raised his mental shield as soon as he was out of the ship. The question now was how much of it still remained. He walked slowly across the room and sat at the table. He felt the .45 digging into his stomach and groin. He also felt it digging into his mind, lying heavy against whatever was left of that shield. "Are those for me?" he asked, pointing at the pills. "I thought we'd have a beer or two together," Bobby said evenly, "the way friends do. And you could take a few of those at a time while we talk. I thought it would be the kindest way." "Kind," Gardner mused. He felt the first faint tug of anger. "Won't get fooled again," the song said, but the habit must be awfully hard to break. He himself had been fooled plenty.
"But then,"
he thought,
"maybe you're an exception to the rule, guard old guard."
"I get the pills, and Peter got that weird sequarium in the shed. Bobby, your definition of kindness has undergone one fuck of a radical change since the days when you'd cry if Peter brought home a dead bird. Remember those days? We lived here together. We stood your sister off when she came and never had to stick her in a shower stall to do it. We just kicked her ass the hell out." He looked at her somberly.
"Remember, Bobby? That was when we were lovers as well as friends. I thought you might have forgotten. I would have died for you, kiddo. And I would have died without you. Remember? Remember us."
Bobby looked down at her hands. Did he see tears in those strange eyes? Probably all he saw was wishful thinking. "When were you in the shed?"
"Last night."
"What did you touch?"
"I used to touch you,"
Gardner mused.
"And you me. And neither of us minded, remember?"
"What did you touch?"
she screamed shrilly at him, and when she looked back up, he didn't see Bobby, but only a furious monster.
"Nothing,"
Gardner said.
"I touched nothing."
The contempt on his face must have been more convincing than any protest would have been, because Bobby settled back. She sipped delicately at her beer. "Doesn't matter. You couldn't have done anything out there anyway."
"How could you do it to Peter?"
"That's how it keeps coming at me. The old man I didn't know, and Ann barged in, but I knew Peter. He would have died for you, too. How could you do it? God's name!"
He kept me alive when you weren't here, Bobby said. There was just the faintest, uneasy, defensive note in her voice. When I was working around the clock. He was the only reason there was anything left for you to save when you got here.
You fucking vampire.
She looked at him, then away.
Jesus Christ, you did something like that, and I went along with it. Do you know how that hurts? I went along. I saw what was happening to you. To a lesser degree, I saw what was happening to the others, but I still went along with it. Because I was crazy. But of course you knew that, didn't you? You used me the same way you used Peter, but I wasn't even as smart as an old beagle dog, I guess, because you didn't even have to put me in the shed and stick one of those filthy, stinking, rotten cables in my head to do it. You just kept me oiled. You handed me a shovel and said, here you go, guard, let's dig this baby up and stop the Dallas police. Except you're the Dallas police. And I went along with it.
Drink your beer, Bobby said. Her face was cold again.
And if I don't?
Then I'm going to turn on this radio, Bobby said, and open a hole in reality and send you somewhere.
To Altair 4?
Gardner asked. He kept his voice casual and tightened his mental grip.
Shield, 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 shield.
On that barrier in his mind. A slight frown creased Bobby's forehead again, and Gardner felt those mental fingers probing again, digging, trying to find out what he knew, how much, and how.
Distractor. Make her mad and distractor. How?
You've been snooping a lot, haven't you? Bobby asked.
Not until I realized how much you were lying to me.
And suddenly knew. He had gotten it in the shed without even knowing it. Most of the lies you told to yourself, guard.
Oh? What about the kid that died, or the one that's blind?
How do you...
The shed. That's where you go to get smart, isn't it?
She said nothing.
You sent them to get batteries. You killed one and blinded the other to get batteries. Jesus, Bobby, how stupid could you get?
We are more intelligent than you could ever hope to...
Who's talking about intelligence?
He cried furiously.
I'm talking about smarts, common fucking sense. The CMP power lines run right behind your house. Why didn't you tap them?
Sure. Bobby smiled with her weird mouth. A really intelligent, pardon me, smart idea. And the first time some tech at the Augusta substation saw the power drain on his dials...
You're running almost everything on CD and AA batteries,
guard said.
That's a trickle. A guy using a house current to run a big bandsaw would bang those needles harder.
She looked momentarily confused. Seemed to listen, not to anyone else, but to her own interior voice. Batteries run on direct current, guard. AC power lines wouldn't do us any... He struck his temples with his fists and screamed,
Haven't you ever seen a goddamn DC converter? You can get them at Radio Shack for $3. Are you seriously trying to tell me you couldn't have made a simple DC converter when you can make your tractor fly and your typewriter run on telepathy? Are you... Nobody thought of it!
She screamed suddenly. There was a moment of silence. She looked stunned as if at the sound of her own voice.